This week on Making Contact.
This area was very fertile, very green area. Now, after the company comes, the whole thing dried up.
With the country's 1991 economic reform package, India significantly reduced trade barriers, moving away from a model of self-sufficiency. Meanwhile, the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund have loaned India money to promote economic growth. Anti-corporate globalization activists warn that this trend towards liberalization has given multinational corporations like Monsanto, Dow, Unilever, and Coca-Cola too much power at the expense of the people. On this edition, we'll take a close-up look at a small town in southern India and their struggle against Coca-Cola. We'll also hear from an Indian journalist and activist, Nityanand Jaraman. I'm Amy Pomerlo, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. The image of Coca-Cola is as American as apple pie. In the United States, the company markets a wide variety of soft drinks, as well as bottled water and Adwala fruit juice. But 70% of Coca-Cola's revenue comes from markets outside the U.S. Coca-Cola's presence in India is fairly new. In 1977, Coke was forced to leave the country when it refused to increase the percentage of its operations owned by the Indian nationals. But in 1995, with new laws that encourage foreign investment, the company returned and built its first new Indian plant on farmland along the Ganges River. Since then, there have been numerous complaints about Coca-Cola's operations throughout the country. Correspondent Jeff Conant reports from Kerala, India, where community activists claim that Coke has destroyed local water sources and demand that Coke leave India for good.
The southern Indian state of Kerala, best known for its lush tropical beauty and its high health and literacy rates, is now the site of an ongoing struggle between the Coca-Cola Corporation and community environmental and human rights activists. Before the year 2000, people in the small rural village of Plachimada had never heard of Coca-Cola. 4 years later, they know Coca-Cola all too well. C.R. Nilakandan, a member of the Anti-Coca-Cola Struggle Committee in Plachimada, is working to get the soft drink company out of India.
Before the struggle starts, nobody thought about cola is good or bad. Now, people started thinking whether cola is good for health or bad, whether it is poisonous, whether it is harmful to health. So now people started thinking, government started thinking, company started thinking, laboratories started studying whether Coca-Cola is poisonous, cadmium, lead, pesticide, all these issues came up.
In January 2000, the Coca-Cola Company received a license to open a bottling plant in the agricultural village of Plachimada. The villagers were told that the plant would be good for the economy. But by early 2002, villagers began to detect problems. A significant drop in the water level in their wells left the village facing a severe water shortage, and a rash of unexplained illnesses caused the villagers to wonder if Coke was the source of their problems. Before Coke arrived, Nilakandan says, the villagers earned a good living from agriculture.
This area was very fertile, very green area. Because we have a lot of water. In the very near, there are two small reservoirs. And downstream, there is another reservoir. These were almost full around the year. Because that gives their water to their drinking water, basically, and agriculture. So they were getting water, even though there isn't rain or no rain. They were getting water from the reservoir. Now, after the company comes, what happens is, because of the extraction, all the three reservoirs, you can even see that, they dried up, they don't have water. Now, even in any borewell, you cannot even pump for 1 hour the water. Earlier, they could run around 24 hours around the clock, the pump, they were getting water. Now, 1 hour, the whole thing dried up, no water.
The Coca-Cola plant extracts 1.5 million liters of groundwater every day at no cost to the company. But with wells drying up and crops dying for lack of water, it is the villagers who seem to be paying the price. The water shortage most directly affects the women, like this villager.
Now we have to walk 2 kilometers to collect water. We have to go 3 or 4 times every day. 2 kilometers, 3 or 4 times a day. So we cannot work. We have to choose, either water or work. If we go for water, we get no work. If we work, we get no water. And if we drink the water, we also cannot work, because we get sick.
Since Coke arrived, villagers have been suffering from a wide range of health problems, something they attribute to poison in the water. Some villagers complain of hair loss and burning in the eyes. Others, like this woman, suffer from muscle spasms and debilitating joint pain.
When we use the water for our families, we have a lot of problems. The first thing that happens is stomach problems from eating the rice. The rice tastes bad, but we have no choice. We eat it anyway. The next thing is itching and sores on our bodies. Then we get patches on different parts of the body. Then we get bone problems, serious bone pain and burning in the eyes. And we lose hair. Even women and children lose hair and become bald.
With no money, few resources, and no other water source in the village, there is not much the villagers can do about their health problems. Mailama has paid many visits to the local hospital, with little result.
We can only go to the local hospital, but they don't know what's wrong with us. They say, don't drink the water, that's all. They give us some medicine, but it doesn't help.
After a July 2002 study, a nearby health clinic declared the water in Plachimata's wells unfit for domestic use. A follow-up investigation by the British Broadcasting Corporation revealed a high level of toxic metals, including lead and cadmium, in the waste byproduct from the Coca-Cola plant. This toxic-bearing sludge has been offered to villagers as fertilizer for their crops or simply dumped in the fields surrounding the plant. But cadmium is a known human carcinogen, and lead exposure is known to cause kidney failure, severe anemia, mental retardation, and other neurological problems. David Santillo, senior scientist at the BBC, noted that the practice of dumping the waste on farm fields has spread the contamination to the water supply at levels well above those set by the World Health Organization. Still, Sunil Gupta, vice president of public affairs at Coca-Cola India, told the BBC that the waste is safe. Across the road from the Coca-Cola plant, local people have staged a sit-in since April 2002. Their strike is a satyagraha, or gesture of non-cooperation, to shame the company into leaving the area. V. Venugopal, chairman of the Plachimata Anti-Coca-Cola Struggle Committee, describes the campaign's demands.
Our first demand is that Coca-Cola leave India. They destroyed the whole environment, the land, water, everything. We also demand that they compensate the village for poisoning our water and our crops and all the health problems. Finally, the employees of the company must get compensation. They are local people that work for the company. When they lose their jobs, they can't support their families, so they should be compensated.
While the community struggles to get the company out, Nilakandan says the local and national governments have done little in response to their demands.
So first thing, they should have stopped. Now government took a totally different stand. They wanted to support Coca-Cola. What they say is, if you say anything against Coca-Cola, we will stop our development because a lot of foreign investment is coming to India. If we say Coca-Cola quit India, no investment will come. So no development.
Making Contact made repeated attempts to speak with Coca-Cola officials. Kari Bjorhus, the Director for Health and Nutrition Communications at Coke's Atlanta headquarters, refused to comment on air about the health problems in Plachimata and referred us to a prepared statement on the company's website. The statement says that there is no environmental harassment to the public by the factory at any level. The statement goes on to say that the company shares the aspirations of the people of Kerala to spur economic growth and create more local jobs. But CR Nilakandan says that the company has called in police on several occasions to put an end to the villagers' demonstrations.
From the day one, there is a police outpost. They are paying to the police, and around sometimes 100 police, sometimes 150 people, police people, sitting inside in front of the company for last 2.5 years. That shows where the government stays, because police is directed by the government.
On August 30th, 2003, 13 activists were arrested during a peaceful demonstration outside the plant, and a community leader was severely beaten by police. Later that year, another demonstration resulted in 140 arrests. But now, after so much time watching the local struggle, even the police are growing sympathetic, and the protest has gained attention across the country. Nilakandan says Plachimada is not the only community having troubles with the company.
Not only here, now in India, so many struggles are going on against Coca-Cola. One is very near to Delhi, North India. It's a very pilgrim place. Near Varanasi, there is a big struggle going on. The place called Mehdi Ganj, in the river Ganges, the biggest river in India. So on the bank of it, they put a factory and they lost their water. So people struggling there. There is very near to Mumbai, there is a plant called Thane, where there is also fight going on. Near Bangalore, there is a fight going on. That's against Pepsi.
In 2003, India's Center for Science and Environment conducted a study revealing still another problem with the soft drink. Coke, Pepsi, and other beverages were found to contain levels of pesticides many times higher than what would be considered safe in the United States. Coca-Cola's website declares their products in India to be safe and says they are tested regularly to ensure they meet rigorous standards. But India has no laws regulating the amount of pesticides allowable in food products, and the study prompted India's own parliament to ban the sale of Coca-Cola in its cafeterias. V. Venugopal says that what started as a local struggle for the villagers of Plachimada has now become part of a struggle for water going on all over the world.
ഈ സമരം തുടങ്ങിയതിൽ ഞങ്ങൾക്ക് ഉള്ള അനുഭവം എന്ന് പറഞ്ഞാൽ ഇന്നത്തെ രാഷ്ട്രീയക്കാർ എന്താണെന്ന് ഞങ്ങൾക്ക് മനസ്സിലാക്കാൻ കഴിഞ്ഞു.
No matter what part of the world, the struggle for water is going on in some form or other. Maybe drilling for water, maybe pollution, maybe diversion, maybe dams. And water is a right and a need of all living beings, not just people. So we are now getting support from all over the world, people joining our struggle. We are all struggling for our lives.
For Making Contact, I'm Jeff Conant in Plachimada, India.
We'll have more about multinational corporations in India in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Nityanand Daraman is a volunteer with the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal. He's also an independent journalist who has extensively covered the role of multinational corporations in India. I spoke with him about Bhopal and the impact of India's liberalization of trade agreements in the 1990s.
Well, India's trade liberalization, I think, falls well within the pattern of activity or reform, as they call it, that has been sweeping the world. It is driven largely by the people who want the reform, that is the corporations and the governments that are controlled by corporations like United States. And they have been driving an agenda to open up the markets of all countries for the entry and free play of multinational capital power. It started, yes, around 1990 would be the time when we could mark it as a watershed, and has had a significant involvement of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, because these are the architects of most of the developing economies, in the sense that they have more say in how the economy changes than the citizens of the country do. And they have dictated to India, to many other countries, as to what needs to be done in order to make the country more comfortable for foreign capital and for large capital. I think it has taken several phases. And right now we are in the, I would say, close to the last phase of liberalization, which means these are the last frontiers for privatization. So we are at a time when the government of India is at least seriously paying attention to demands by global corporate power and by OECD countries to open up their markets for privatization, particularly in the health sector and the education sector, the health sector, education sector, and the water sector, which is the services. It hasn't happened yet, but the writing's on the wall. And going by the way things have been moving in the last 10 to 15 years, we know exactly where we are headed.
So why has the world, if you can pull that apart, why the World Bank and the IMF have had such a tremendous influence?
Well, it has been it's been a kind of a vicious dependency that the Indian government has almost become addicted to the money, that's been handed out by the World Bank, to the point that we cannot clean our sewage without going for a loan to the World Bank. That dependency is also meant, I mean, I don't think it's only a one-way dependency where the government has been begging for money. It has been actively given. It's almost an addiction that has been nurtured by the people whose money needed play in countries like India. Who makes the decisions for the World Bank, or who calls the shots in the World Bank? That's also very clear. It's a small group, it's a cabal of industrialized nations who call the shots of the World Bank. Currently, India is among the largest. The amount of money that they repay as interest to the loan is among the largest in the world. So, in a sense, India, Brazil are probably very big players in the World Bank as debtor nations, which means the World Bank has India in a much stronger stranglehold than most of the places.
And how's the face of India changed since this shift has occurred?
See, the thing is, the country is quite large and there are many, many issues, so it's very difficult to see the additional damage done in the last 10 years. What we do see is the infrastructure for new damage to be created being built up on a very, very fast pace. So if you're talking about mining, which is a deadly business, which takes away land, the most important resource in India today is land and water. And these are the two resources that are being captured when we talk about large-scale development, as the World Bank types put it. So we have a huge expansion in mining as an industry. We have a pretty halted view, you know, a kind of blinkered view of development as something that can only happen through big industrialization, which means that everything that has to do with small farms, small businesses, artisanal fisheries, all these things are considered non-viable in the global scheme of things. And the only things that are being pushed are big things, and big things cause big damage. They need big land, need lots of water. And these are the things that we cannot afford to give away. So in that sense, you see quite a large number of people being displaced, new environmental refugees or refugees of development. And in India, that these would number in the millions. The other changing phase, I would say, which is quite marked, is the rapid penetration of consumerism. And this has been quite an interesting phenomenon, because with consumerism comes the garbage that the consumers generate. If you look at the development index, I mean, did they say that the more you consume, the more developed you are, the more waste you generate, the more developed you are? So in those rankings, I think the Americans and the Japanese rank the top most in terms of the amount of garbage generated, the amount of earth that they consume. And in India, that has been changing rapidly, where we are nowhere near the Americans or the Japanese, but are desperately trying to get there. And in the process, we are adding to the rapacious greed on Earth's resources. The only danger being that if India goes the way of the US or Japan, there would be no planet left to live on, just given the amount of pressure that 1 billion people can bring to bear. So you see the countryside littered with the garbage that consumerism generates, with absolutely no knowledge of how to deal with it. And we don't anticipate that knowledge to come because we've come to other countries like the US and Japan, where these countries have literally thought that they've solved the problem of garbage by exporting it, either to poorer regions within their country or to poorer regions within the world. So our only option then, as a country that aspires to be like America, would be to generate as much garbage as we can and dump it in other poorer places if they will accept it.
Can you give me a specific example of a multinational company that has created refugees of development, as you call them?
Sure. I mean, if Union Carbide actually has a dubious distinction of causing all kinds of damage. I mean, it's the impact of the kind of legacy it's left behind in India is not specific, is not restricted to any one particular field. It has caused a very wide-ranging effect on about half of an entire city's population. And I'm talking about Bhopal, where in 1984, Union Carbide's pesticide factory blew up, killing several thousand people overnight, and close to 20,000 people have died till date as a result of the long-lasting effects of the poison gases. In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, some of the people were so traumatized that they left everything that they had in Bhopal and left the city. They've just gone to various places. One doesn't know where they are. Many of the children who ran away from that place, lost their parents, still haven't returned. So those guys are out at large. So they created an undisclosed number of refugees as a result of the disaster. What they have left behind are the people who do not have the strength to run. These are also people who are refugees in one sense of the word, because they're almost in a foreign land in their own country, in their own hometown, because they're left without any support. They don't have the physical ability to work because their health has been compromised by the long-term effects of the gas. About 80% of the victims of the gas disaster were from the working class population, which means they had to go out and toil for a day, and the day's earnings is what would run the family. Now, these people are not able to work anymore, which means they don't have the ability to earn. So now they've been pushed from the poverty line into destitution. They are refugees of a kind. They don't have any access to health care because our government is so screwed up that we really don't even focus on the most needy. They don't have access to clean water because the government of India doesn't see it as a priority that people who have been victimized by a disaster should be given some kind of a relief. In a sense, they're being re-victimized by the refusal of the government to provide clean water, provide services. So these guys are the people who are left behind, the gas-affected people who are left behind in Bhopal, are refugees of the worst kind. You know, they're not even moved out of the place, but they've been made homeless, they've been made supportless in their own lands.
It seems like the standards by which these companies are holding themselves are very different from what they would be doing in their own country of origin in the U.S. versus how they operate their companies in India or other countries around the world.
You know, I wish that were true, but unfortunately not. I mean, these companies are as insensitive of the needs of the people, of the accountability requirements towards their workers, towards communities, towards the shareholders in America, as they are elsewhere. Over here, of course, the people are in some kind of a comfortable cocoon, thinking they really have solved these problems. They haven't. And I'm sitting in Oakland, which itself is a toxic hotspot. Next to me, there's Richmond County, or Richmond, where there's a whole bunch of, you know, minority communities. I wouldn't say that corporations behave differently in America. They probably behave slightly more carefully. Yes, there are more checks and balances, but there never can be enough, because the government does not have the political will, not in India, not in America, does not have the political will to rein in corporations and make them behave and make their interests secondary to the interests of society. And until that happens, I don't think anything is going to change.
And let's talk about the UN Initiative Global Compact. What role has it played, or can it play, in helping to regulate corporations?
Oh, it hasn't played. The Global Compact, which was a brainchild of Kofi Annan and a bunch of corporations, has not played any role in improving the behavior of the corporations. and will not play any role in improving the behavior of the corporations. Primarily because it's not legally binding. It's a voluntary code. We have laws that the companies will not obey. We have laws that the companies will flout. And the companies have been flouting very, very actively. Then I don't see how a voluntary agreement, you know, will change their behavior. It's like telling a drug peddler to, you know, do it carefully.
Well, what do you see as effective ways to fight against these corporations?
I think one is that these corporations must not be given any place to run. There must be international regulation, legally binding regulation, that treats criminal corporations as criminals, where the countries of the world get together and say that no matter where criminals go, we can pursue them. And they would be, the course of law would be allowed to follow. So I would think something along the lines of a United Nations Convention on corporate crime would be a good way to go. In fact, there is already something to that effect. It's a fledgling kind of initiative by a subcommittee of the United Nations to formulate norms for transnational behavior, particularly to do with human rights. These norms are a good starting point. They are not all, but they're a good starting point. But unfortunately, as corporations and industrialized countries have ganged up against such a regulation, at a time when not just one corporation, several corporations have committed murder, committed robbery, committed theft, committed all kinds of stuff, and are at large.
What has it been like for you as an activist in this struggle? Do you feel like you've made inroads?
I don't know. I mean, I think as activists, we go more on a day-by-day, week-by-day, week-by-week basis. So some days we're happy, some days we're sad. Some weeks we're happy, some weeks we're sad. But in the long run, I think in the last 20 years, the only thing that has happened positively is to give us a much clearer resolve that corporations are not willing to change on their own, that they have to be made to change. It has also given us a certain amount of wisdom that now we can tell corporate bull from truth. We know and anticipate the government's responses. Beyond that, just in terms of real terms, in Bhopal, for instance, for the magnitude of the crime, for the magnitude of the disaster and the suffering over there, I would say 20 years of fight have got us very little. And it is unfortunate that neither the government of India, government of the United States, or the corporations involved actually see the human misery in it. They don't get the point.
That was Nityanand Jaraman, volunteer with the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal and independent journalist based in India. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Eric Klein, Erica Bridgman, Jeff Conant, Gopal Dianeni, Nadia Kastagir, Sandra Lupien, and Anne Bacon for production assistance. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production, funded primarily by individual contributors. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of the program, Refugees of Development, India and Multinationals, program number 1804, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Pauline Bartolone, associate producer, Susanna Hines, associate manager, Prashant McKee, office manager, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and director of production and training, Amy Pomerleau.